For many years, I traveled this world by myself, giving family life conferences. And I have had the experience and could have, if I wanted to speak to this many people in conferences or around the country all by myself. But I have discovered that far more effective is to join a team. But I'm convinced that my own ministry is far, far more effective as I team up with these people than it has been going it alone. And so I would recommend to you, if you want to make your ministry increasingly effective, then don't work alone. Submit yourself to a team. And I found that team effort is far more effective. And this is true in marriage too, isn't it? The marriages that are in trouble are marriages where a man is going to go it alone. And his wife is going to go it alone. And the two of them are competitors. The most effective business enterprise is not where the individual goes it alone. And the individuals in the organization want to do their own thing. The really effective business organizations are the ones where people subject themselves to a team. I believe this is true in church, too. The church where everybody goes his own way and does his own thing and leave me be isn't nearly as effective as the church that works together. A fellow came up here a while ago and asked me to sign one of his books. Paperback book. And I just like to announce that I've decided to sign one paperback if you buy two paperbacks. And he was a kind of a roly-poly fellow. And he said that his friend asked him to ask me to tell you a story about, I'll tell you the story. It has to do with eating. And it's tied to a scripture verse in Hebrews 10, verse 24. I didn't mean to talk about this, but since he brought it up, I will. Listen to this. Let us consider one another. Now, this is really, come to think of it, related to my introductory remarks. Let us consider one another. Now, you know, that idea isn't so popular these days. It's the other way around, isn't it? Let me do my own thing. Let me alone. Mind your own business. Let me mind my own business. Now, this basic idea of let us consider one another, pay attention to one another, let's be responsible to one another, let's report to one another, is quite a different idea than this basic concept of let us consider one another. I think a lot of the loneliness of the day has to do with the fact that everybody wants to do his own thing. And everybody wants to be free. And you know, the most miserable people that I talk to in a consulting room are the people who have managed to become free. They're doing their own thing. You know what that means? It means they're alone. And to be alone is to be lonely. Oh, it sounds so attractive to be free, but that also means to be alone. Now, the idea in this verse is quite a bit different. Let us consider one another, and let us provoke one another. Go around provoking one another? That's what it says. Let us provoke one another. Now, what could that accomplish? Let us provoke one another unto love. Well, you know, that's not a bad idea, is it? To stimulate one another to be nicer people. That's what we've been trying to do here this week. is to make you aware of yourself. Are there any people around here? You're an old crab. You flare up when people don't do it the way you think, or when you're crossed. You know, I'd just simply like to prod you a little bit to recognize that there is a better way. There's a different spirit than that. It's possible that there are men and women here. You're our husband and wives, and you're not friends. You don't like each other. There's a better way than that. There is the possibility of you and your partner being reconciled one with another. You don't have to walk around unhappy, being annoyed all day. Your own sense of peace and serenity kind of dependent upon what other people do because your own reactions are so fragile. Now, here's a pretty good idea. Let us consider one another and to provoke one another unto love and good works. You know, it shouldn't be that we accept the fellow who's grumpy and crabby and obnoxious all the time. We ought to challenge him. Sometimes you hear folks say, now be careful how you talk around him because he's apt to explode. You know, I think it should be the other way around. Rather than being so cautious around the fellow who tends to explode, we ought to put the guy that explodes on the spot. What's the matter with you? I just suggest to you that let's turn it around the other way. You see, it isn't I'm not responsible for your nasty spirit. I don't need to be careful how I talk to you because if your heart is filled with love, the only thing I can stir up is your love. If your heart is filled with joy, what'll I do? I'll just stir up your joy. Now, if your heart is filled with anger, I'm going to stir up your anger. What determines how you react to me? Me? Oh, no. You do. You ever stop to think about that? So let us provoke one another unto love. And when this individual becomes cantankerous and unhappy and miserable, our reaction ought to be, what's the matter with you? Not what did I do? Now my responsibility is to take care of my spirit. But your spirit is not my responsibility. That's yours. Let us provoke one another unto good works. Let us provoke one another to eliminate the things we do that aren't efficient and effective and good, wholesome. And now comes my story. I was at this banquet one time. And it was a family-style banquet at a church where you passed things and you designed your own plate. And I'm sitting next to the minister, and you should have seen the plate of food that fellow took. Well, it's not that caught my attention as much as when he ate it, this big plate of food. He filled it up again. And I couldn't get my eyes off that second plate of food. And he noticed it. And so he leaned over and whispered to me, he said, I am a compulsive eater. Now, what's a good provocative answer to that kind of a remark? If you're a compulsive eater, after all, there's not much you can do about that, is there? Or is there? Well, this was my answer. See what you think of it. I said to him, sir, I believe there's a better word for it than that. And the word is intemperance. And with reference to food, there's even a better word for it than that. It's called gluttony. And do you know
That provoked him. His wife told me that he went home and he got out his Greek Testament and he looked up those words. And you know what he discovered? He discovered that intemperance is sin. Temperance is a fruit of the Spirit of God. God will put within you a drive, a burden, to be moderate, to be temperate. Intemperance is the opposite. Now, if temperance is a fruit of the Spirit of God, then what is intemperance? If one of the fruits of the Spirit of God is patience, then what is impatience? If one of the fruits of the Spirit of God is joy, then what is misery? This fellow discovered that gluttony was sin. And you know, that was good to provoke him. Well, about a year later, I was invited to come to speak to this church at a banquet. You see, what I said earlier, I'm banking on the second reaction that people have to what I say. I'm not so much concerned about the first reaction. And here's an individual who very gratefully invited me back to the next annual church affair, the big hoop to do for the year. Invited me back, and there we were sitting at a table. And he said to me, "Henry, you're heavier than you were a year ago." And I said, "Yes, sir, I, since I've seen you last, I've been to so many banquets. And people invite me out, and everybody wants to just feed me and feed me. And you just can't turn these people down." He said, "Henry, there's a better word for it." And he said, "The word is intemperance. And with reference to food, there's a better word. It's called gluttony." You know, that fellow gave me my little speech right back in my teeth. He provoked me. You know what? We need each other. I think I'd be an awful lot heavier than I am if it weren't for the fact that I run into that fellow every once in a while. And when I do, I size up his waistline, and he sizes up mine. And he and I, many times, remind ourselves that with reference to food, there is such a thing as intemperance. And I just want to share that with all of you here. And this is my concern in many areas. Some of you are intemperate in the way you eat. Some of you are intemperate in the fact that you work too much. And it isn't because you have to, it's because you want to. Some of your businesses would be better off if you weren't there that much. You don't have to chase around as much as you do. Some of you are intemperate in the fact that you just simply neglect your kids. You are not home enough, and you are not home enough because you don't want to be, not because you can't be. You're so interested in some other things that you're doing that you neglect a responsibility that is yours. And one of the difficulties in our world, if you have any kind of talent or ability at all, is that you can get so involved in something that fascinates you, and you love it, and you enjoy it. And you don't have to make choices between good and bad. You make choices between excellent things. You know, I have the opportunity to decide whether I want to be in Florida in March or California. Now, isn't that rough? I'm going from here to one of the most beautiful parts, as far as I'm concerned, one of the nicest spots in the world, up in the rolling mountains behind Vancouver, BC, to a beautiful hot spring resort to have a layman's conference. Isn't that rough? Now, a lot of us, those are the kind of choices we have to make. We have to choose between things excellent, and the world fascinates us so much that we can become, if you don't walk in the Spirit of God, you will become intemperate and overly engrossed in one area of your life that fascinates you and neglect another area of your life. And so this morning, what I'm trying to do is to provoke you unto love. There isn't any reason for any of you walking out of this room being an old crab, grumpy, and you're going to flare up when you don't hear what you want to hear. You don't have to be a stubborn, I'm going to do my own thing and go my own way. The spirit, there's another spirit that's far better. And that spirit is, let us consider one another. You are responsible for your brother. What you do does affect what I do. You know, wherever I go, people as here swamp me. They want to see me personally. And many, many times I listen to somebody's story and I take my little book and I want to talk about the Bible and the individual says, don't bother me with that Bible. I'm fed up with people who profess to know that Bible. And you see what somebody else did affects my opportunity to present my case out of this Bible. It does make a difference to me what you have done. And even this week, as I have talked to some people, my opportunity to be useful and helpful to some of these people is interfered with because somebody else was inconsiderate of those people. So we have a responsibility to each other. And what you do, and what I pay attention to what you do, I am minding my own business because what you do affects what I do. And there are many, many people whose conception of Christianity is clouded and confused simply because they met you, or their concept of Christianity is clarified and they are challenged to consider the Lord once more because they met you. Well, so much for that. Now I'll get down to what I came to talk about this morning. I want to talk about parenthood. I came across a statement here. Let me read it to you. This was made by Socrates in 469 BC. 469 BC. If I would get to the highest place in Athens, I would lift up my voice and say, what mean ye, fellow citizens, that you turn every stone to scrape wealth together and take so little care of your children to whom you must one day relinquish it all? That's a good question, isn't it? We have to pay attention to those children of ours. They're going to be the leadership in a few years. It hasn't been so very long that you were kids. And now you're calling some of the shots. I look at my son. This is the same guy that we couldn't get to make his bed for 20 years. His goal was not to study. And that's a young man. He's now 28 years old. And he's on the faculty at the Michigan State University Graduate School. That kid is on the faculty of a graduate school. Believe it or not. I'll tell you, it doesn't take very long before your little kids start influencing the educators of the world. And I began to realize that, my, what a difference it made, what kind of input this young man was exposed to. And you know, we did take the trouble when our children were small to spend time with them. We had to decide, for instance, whether we were going to raise grass or kids in our backyard. And we decided that in our backyard we were going to raise children. And so the children in our neighborhood were in our backyard. You know what we discovered? If you want children in your backyard, you're not going to have much competition. We decided that our house would be the hangout. And so we had my wife and I were involved in a Sunday school class in our church. High school and college young people. My, where are high school and college young people going to go these days? Well, we tried to be the magnet and to draw them into our house so that we could influence their lives. You know, we even designed some retreats in order to help these kids meet their friends. And right now in our church, there are some kids who met their wives and their husbands at those retreats, and that was one of the goals. We cared who these kids married. We cared who these kids associated with. And we wanted to be the center of something that is wholesome and positive, constructive in the lives of these young people. Now, what did that do? That cost us a lot of money. These people would come wandering into our house Sunday nights. We'd put out the food. Boy, did they eat. Our icebox was available. They messed up our rugs. But down in a recreation room were always a bunch of kids. And up in the living room were always a bunch of kids. And some of the happy memories that I have is still some of those young people sitting around at our house. Because we meant to influence those young people. Here a few months ago, I was down here in Florida, and I called up my wife. And there was a lot of, it wasn't my wife that answered the phone, it was a male voice. And so I kind of casually, when my wife got to the phone, asked, who was that? Well, you know, it was our son, Dick. He's 28 now and married, and he still wants to come home and toast his shins on our fireplace. You know, I like that. That after all we've been through, that this fellow wants to come home and be with his dad and be with his mother. And my wife said, there's 28 kids in this house. You know who they were? They were Dick's gang that he used to play with when he was a kid. And one of the fellows is now a missionary, and he came home, and there's the old gang. And when the old gang wants to assemble, where do they go? They come over to our house. I like that. And they can mess up our rug. That's great. We'll buy another rug. You know, here a while ago at our house, we had, 85 people, I guess, maybe more. The old Sunday school class. You know, we still like to have those people come on over to our house. You know what happened that night? These are folks that we've known and worked with for years and years. And one of the young people in our Sunday school class, they had a little baby. And this little baby developed some intestinal problems. And this little baby had been in a hospital for over a year. Just breaking that young couple. And somebody said, you know, we ought to put our prayers together on behalf of that little baby. And here we were, putting our prayers together on the behalf of somebody in our class. You know, it's the idea of let us consider one another. Let's look out for each other. Let's be concerned about one another. And some of these folks, when they get into trouble, they still know where to come. I'm trying to say, don't be so busy that you fail to create some kind of a rapport with your children and that you make what you've got available to your children and that you know where they are. I was talking to somebody here. He was having some difficulties with his boy, I guess 18 or 19 years old. And the boy wouldn't behave. And so he says, if you don't behave, get out. And so he sent him away from home. You know what I say to my 18-year-old boy? If you don't behave, I'll clobber you. I'm going to make you behave. I'm not going to be sending my 18-year-old boy out into the world. I'm going to do what I have to do in order to help him because I love him. I haven't got anything to lose to fight for my boy. And I haven't got anything to lose to fight for my two daughters. And we fought for our kids. And they're still with us. And I believe that there's some things that you have to do if you want to win and guide and keep your children. And one of them is you've got to keep God first in your life. Here just a while ago, a few months ago, my son came to me. He said, Dad, let me back up a little bit. At 16 years old, when he was 16, I remember we took a tour of the plants. And one of his buddy's dads ran a punch press. Great big high thing, as high as the top of this ceiling. And what they did is put a big chunk of metal through there, and this fellow pushed a button, and that big thing came down, and there was a whole top of a car, and my son looked at that googly-eyed. And there, they'd roll in another thing, and this fellow would push a button, and that thing came down. Boy, that impressed my son. This fellow driving this great, big, huge punch press. He didn't realize that all the fellow did was push a button. Well, we went into another department, and there was another one of my buddies, Dad. And he ran a lift truck. And he'd zip that lift truck around. Wow, that sure impressed my son. And he'd push a button and zip up this big, huge load and drove off. My son looked at me and said, Dad, why don't you do something useful? That's when he was 16. When it came time for him to go to college, he didn't want to go to college because most of his buddies weren't going to college. He wanted to get a job and make some money. You see, you could just walk right out of high school and go into a plant and get a job, $2.68 an hour or something. And these fellows came around with money jingling in their pockets the next week. And the week after that, they came wheeling into our driveway with a new car. And poor Dick, he had to go to college. Man, he didn't like that. He didn't want to do it. I'll go to night school. I knew Dick better than that. He wouldn't be going to night school. So we shipped him off to college. And he came home that first summer, and he got a job in the factory. He had a job. The axles came along, and he had to push a button and bring something down that clamped those axles and moved it over there and stored them. That was his job. Push a button. That was his job. You know what? He looked at me, and he was ashamed of me because I didn't work. That's what he said. But after that first summer, he gave up working, too. You You know, you start looking a little smarter to your kids after they have a little bit of experience. And a lot of the reason why some of our children are so smart is simply because they don't know what they don't know.
A lot of freshmen today can run a university, they think. I don't know how to, but they do. And the only reason that they think they do is because they don't know what they don't know. And our children need our guidance.
And now here it is, long many years ago, and I sat down with my son just a few months ago, and my son was saying, you know, Dad, I've been watching these fellows around this university, and they're mighty smart, and they got their degrees. And of course, my son is Dr. Brandt now, too. We got two of them in the family. Now, his buddies, they have a little hard time accepting him as Dr. Brandt, so they call him Dr. Brandt Jr., just to cut him down as much as they can. But he said, I've been watching what those fellows do with their time, and I've been watching what you do with your time. And he said, Dad, how do I get into what you're doing? Now, I kind of like that. You know, I want to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow night, but I want to tell you, you better stop and think what you do with your time. And you need to give your children some kind of an impression of what is really important. And if they watched you and watched what you do with your 24 hours in a day, what kind of conclusions would your children draw? Would they conclude that your hope is in another world? Or would they conclude that as far as you're concerned and the way you use your 24 hours a day, that all there is this world? There's one of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:12, that says this, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God has given you. I think that's very basic and fundamental, that you expect your children to honor you. And I believe one of the best ways that you can make it possible for your children to honor you is for you to be worthy of it. Several years ago, I made myself available at Campus Crusade for Christ for 3 months. 3 months I sat there listening to young people. I just gave them an opportunity to come in, and for 3 months I sat across the desk on a one-to-one relationship with many of these college students who became Christians when they were sophomores and juniors and seniors in college as a result of the ministry of Campus Crusade for Christ. Why did they become Christians? They become Christians because some of the people in this organization were burdened enough so that we sat down and developed a strategy for reaching those people. And there were people who went to that campus, and their objective was to try to get involved with college students and rescue them. And I'll tell you, you come to our headquarters in San Bernardino in the summertime, anytime you want, and you'll see thousands of college students swarming around the place. You may feel alone sometimes, but I want to say, just look around you. You're not alone. We are part of a healthy, vibrant movement, believe me. And I can show you, I can take you to several hundred college campuses in this United States, and there's another side to the college campus, and that is the vibrant, healthy, young college student who has met Jesus. We're seeing that happening in high school. And as I travel around this country, and I'm going to a meeting tonight in a church, and there will be 1,000 people there, and I'm used to speaking in churches where there are multiplied hundreds and hundreds of people, and this is going on all over the country, and I'm saying, lift up your eyes. There's something wholesome and healthy going on in this country. And don't just filter out all the challenge. And there's three men walking by right now, just in a meeting with them, Bill Bright, Howard Ball, who have a burden for this world. And you should leave here with a burden for this world, and your children ought to realize that you have a burden for the world. Well,
one of the best ways for you to have your children honor you is for you to be worthy of it. And you know what these kids said? I began to realize that there was a theme developing. These young people who met Jesus on a college level, and many of them would say, "Doc, one of the things that troubles me is what can I do to help my well-groomed, well-fed, well-housed, well-educated, nervous, unpredictable, unhappy mother?" You know what a sad thing when you see a woman in her 40s and her skin is so nice and her hair is so pretty and she looks so nice and she's nervous and she's jumpy and she's cantankerous and she's cold and unresponsive. What a tragedy. And how easy it is for you to look after your hair and look after your skin and look after your wardrobe and make sure your jewelry is right and everything matches. And underneath all of that is this nasty woman. And that was the burden on the hearts of these kids. You know what they said? "Dad, Doc, what can I do for my dedicated, determined, successful, wealthy, influential, unhappy, self-centered father?" Isn't that sad? This fellow with this big car, and this fellow who can buy this big house, and this fellow who commands all of these employees. And his net worth grows, and he gets harder to live with. So you drive your miserable self around in your big car. Many young people are saying today, "What's the use of getting rich? To turn out like my dad? What's the use of aspiring to a big house? To become a wreck like my mother? What's the point in going to church? It hasn't done my dad any good." Oh, do you realize how strategic your own character becomes? Some of you, you've neutralized your influence over your children simply because you and your wife are fighting all the time. And if you can't get anywhere with your mother, all you need to do is turn to your dad, because you know that your mother and father are competitors. And all you need to do is get dad committed. And if you can get him committed, he'll take mother on and fight to the bitter end. And all you need to do is stand aside and stay out of the way until he settles it. And then there are some other things. All you've got to do is get your mother on your side, and she'll take dad on. And isn't it amazing what some of these little bitty women do and how they control those big, strong men? Why, these men could crush them. But these women have a mystical power, don't they? And we've taught our children simply to manipulate one another and maneuver one another, but not to be on the same team. And I believe a lot of parenthood involves simply living in such a way that when you say to your son and your daughter, "I expect you to honor me," that you've got the right to say it, and you've earned the right to say it because you are an honorable man. And you are an honorable woman. And you've given up your rights, sir, and your wife has given up hers, and the two of you have become one. Lord, this is a mystery to me that I spend all this time saying something else. But I would pray for these people.
I'm sure most of us have come here searching. And we know that if we'll yield ourselves to you, that you can control our minds and you can control our mouths. And for whatever it's worth, and for whoever you know has needed what I've had to say, I'll commit it to you.